Welcome back to the program. There's a fundamental law of physics that says that for every action, there is an equal reaction. 1 year ago, the death of Osama bin Laden created much speculation about the demise of Al-Qaeda and the future of that organization. Still to this day, 1 year later, there are many unanswered questions. Where are we in the war on terror? What is the state of Al-Qaeda today, and what impact is the Arab Spring having on the spread of Al-Qaeda? For better or for worse, we've had to learn a great deal about the organization and about counterterrorism in the days and years since 9/11. But what does the future look like? Perhaps we can best understand that by examining the past, particularly Al-Qaeda, since 9/11. We're going to talk about this today with my guest, Seth Jones. He's a former senior advisor to U.S. Special Operations Command, currently a senior analyst at the RAND Corporation and an adjunct professor at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School, and the author of a new book entitled Hunting in the Shadows, The Pursuit of Al-Qaeda Since 9/11. Seth Jones, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. It's great to be on, Jeff.
It's good to have you here. Many have argued that since the death of Osama bin Laden, that Al-Qaeda has essentially become irrelevant. Talk a little bit about your views.
Well, I think the issue is to first define what Al-Qaeda is. Al-Qaeda today is a different organization than it was a year ago, certainly different from what it was on September 11th. It does have a command and control node in Pakistan, whose senior leader now is Ayman al-Zawahiri, an Egyptian. He replaced Osama bin Laden. That organization has been weakened a little bit because of the death of a range of senior officials, but they've been replaced. But in particular, what we've seen is a number of affiliated groups. These are groups that have generally called themselves now Al-Qaeda, have sworn loyalty to the organization, and that are operating with it on multiple fronts. And we see those in Yemen, Somalia, Iraq, and North Africa. We also see some groups that have allied with it. That is, they may have different objectives, but will conduct training together or specific operations. So that element of Al-Qaeda, we've seen, has grown somewhat.
One of the things you talk about is that with respect to Al-Qaeda today, along with these affiliated groups that are part of it in some respects, that the use of technology and social media has become a big part of how it operates.
What is very interesting in watching several of Al-Qaeda's historical waves, that is their increases in strength and their ability then to conduct attacks, is how much they have used the internet and social media for recruitment, for financial efforts to get money from individuals, for radicalization purposes, and just generally to communicate. So Anwar al-Awlaki, the Yemeni American who was killed in 2011 from a drone strike in Yemen, was particularly adept at putting his sermons and his writings out on Twitter, on YouTube, on jihadi internet sites, and on Facebook, and to reach young radicalized Muslims, or to try and radicalize young Muslims through social media forums.
In fact, you talk about how he had even been in touch with Hassan, the guy that perpetrated the Fort Hood shootings.
That's exactly right. Anwar al-Awlaki and Major Hassan, who was a U.S. Army soldier about to be deployed to Afghanistan, were in fairly regular contact over email, some of which was monitored by the United States government. But that certainly encouraged him to conduct the shooting at Fort Hood, which killed a number of Americans, mostly soldiers. And then the ability to then connect on the internet and for Hassan to read Awlaki's sermons on social media sites was key to that radicalization.
Going back, talk about the three waves that you delineate with respect to Al-Qaeda, the second wave being essentially 9/11.
Well, it's very important to understand, and it's sometimes there's a misnomer that Al-Qaeda is a linear group, that its strength has been linear, that it peaked maybe on September 11th and then has declined since then. In fact, when you look at key indicators like its ability to perpetrate attacks and the results of those attacks, so fatalities caused by Al-Qaeda attacks, you see three major waves. The first one really begins in the 1990s, 1998 embassy bombings in Africa, targeting two different U.S. embassies. the USS Cole that was targeted by al-Qaeda, and then peaks around September 11th with the killing of nearly 3,000 Americans in New York City. That's then followed by a reverse wave as al-Qaeda loses its sanctuary in Afghanistan. Several of its key members are captured, a few killed, but mostly captured. But by 2003, we see a second wave, in part because of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, which radicalizes a number of Muslims. And then, so we had seen a decrease in al-Qaeda activity. By 2003 and 4 and 5, we see a major increase. We see al-Qaeda attacks, not just in Iraq, but in Bali, in Casablanca. In 2005, the big four attackers in London, Madrid, which al-Qaeda was at least involved in on the outskirts. But then it's then led to a second reverse wave as al-Qaeda is defeated on multiple fronts. And then by 2008 and 9, when al-Qaeda gains a sanctuary in Yemen and al-Awlaki becomes a key individual in that movement, we see then a third wave, which we see a growth in attacks across multiple continents. And then by the time that bin Laden is killed, that wave, that third wave, declines.
Al-Qaeda getting a foothold in Yemen was a major component of this third wave that you're talking about.
Yemen was critical. Now, what's interesting about Yemen is Al-Qaeda's first effort on the Arabian Peninsula, and that's what it called itself, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, was in Saudi Arabia. So after the overthrow of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan, Osama bin Laden encouraged and pushed in fighters, several cells into Saudi Arabia, to try to overthrow the Saudi government. They failed. And by 2007, they were in terrible shape. A number of their key individuals were captured or killed. They then turned to Yemen. And by 2008 and 2009, Nasir al-Wahishi becomes the leader of that organization in Yemen. And they establish a foothold in an area around the Gulf of Aden that has largely been untouched by the Yemen government. So they find a key sanctuary in the very same country where they had perpetrated the USS Cole bombings about 9 years before.
But one of the things that perpetuated this reverse wave that you talk about is the fact that they went too far in terms of civilian casualties in Iraq.
When you look at al-Qaeda's activities, U.S. strategy has varied quite a bit. Al-Qaeda's strategy in its use of violence has also varied. So we see al-Qaeda in Iraq, al-Qaeda more broadly, involved in very limited selective attacks that target embassies or individuals or military structures like the USS Cole, which is a ship. But we also have seen it, as in Iraq, targeting civilians, large numbers of civilians, both Sunni and Shia. And where al-Qaeda has done that, where it's attacked and killed large numbers of civilians, especially Muslims, it has significantly undermined its support base. So al-Qaeda has gone too far on many occasions and really set itself up for massive weakening, what we call a reverse wave.
And has the leadership of al-Qaeda and its various affiliates learned from that experience with respect to the civilian casualties in Iraq? Because one of the things you talk about that might trigger a fourth wave would be the continuation of civilian casualties caused by al-Qaeda.
Parts of al-Qaeda have learned from it. I would say if al-Qaeda were to, there are several factors that might cause a fourth wave. In fact, I would say we're really kind of at the beginning of a fourth wave. If al-Qaeda were very selective in its attacks, it would likely prevent itself from being undermined. But we've seen, especially its affiliate in Iraq, al-Qaeda in Iraq, continue to use violence against civilians, especially Shia. Even earlier in 2012, in January, al-Qaeda in Iraq targeted a number of Shia on pilgrimages. And that affiliate has created a lot of headaches for the organization in Pakistan because it keeps resorting to civilian casualties.
Talk about the structure of al-Qaeda. As you say, not linear at all, but in many ways like a business.
Yeah, what's interesting when you actually look at the way al-Qaeda has historically been structured, and even today to some degree, It has a leader, and that's Ayman al-Zawahiri. It has a deputy, that's Abu Yahya al-Libi. But it also has a range of key individuals, a shura, that advises the leaders. And when they make decisions, they generally look for consensus among leaders. But what's most interesting is the fact that, like any organization, they need to function. So they have established a range of shuras or committees that deal with things like finances, with military operations, that deal with training, external operations, attacks overseas, but also dealing with the affiliates in countries like Iraq and Yemen. They have a media wing that pushes out propaganda. So they're divided into a range of functional committees so the organization can continue to operate and work with its nodes overseas.
Given that, what impact did the elimination of Osama bin Laden actually have on the organization?
It had two impacts. One is it by removing the leader, it at least temporarily decreased the ability of the central or core node in Pakistan to communicate with leaders in Yemen and Somalia, North Africa, and Iraq. But second, and probably more important, the death of bin Laden, in combination with the killing of a range of individuals, the general manager, Atiya Abdulrahman, head of external operations, Ilyas Kashmiri, and a range of others, that pattern of drone strikes forced al-Qaeda to limit its communications with itself. There were major time lags in when it could get information to its affiliates or when they could get information to the core node in Pakistan. So it made it very difficult for the Pakistan element to communicate outside, to communicate with itself, and then to conduct operations.
Have we taken appropriate advantage of the weaknesses that al-Qaeda inherently showed as a result of the death of bin Laden?
In some cases, yes. We have taken advantage of weaknesses in several of the countries where al-Qaeda operates, including Yemen. It does not have a large support base among some of the Yemeni tribes, sub-tribes, and clans, some of which have been willing to provide information on the location of al-Qaeda individuals. That weakness in some areas of a support base has allowed the U.S. and its allies, in this case the Yemen government, to target some leaders like Anwar al-Awlaki. But in others, in Iraq, for example, the U.S. has pulled out its forces, its military forces from Iraq, and decreased its ability to influence what is going on. So in some cases, like Iraq, then, the U.S.'s ability to take advantage of the vacuum has actually declined.
What impact, then, hypothetical though it may be, would the impact have been on al-Qaeda had we not invaded Iraq?
I would say, based on what we now know, and in my book, I spoke to a range of senior FBI, CIA, British intelligence, both the domestic agency MI5 and the external one MI6, and a range of others who argued very strongly that the invasion of Iraq, more than anything else, and some of the incidents that came out of it, like the photographs from Abu Ghraib, radicalized individuals within their own homelands, among British Pakistanis, for example. So it looks like strongly there's a fair amount of evidence that had the U.S. not invaded Iraq, that most of that radicalization would not have taken place. There might have been some radicalization caused by other things, but the vast majority of plots in Madrid, in London, and other locations were to a major degree caused by the Iraq invasion.
And the effectiveness of these drone strikes in taking out some additional al-Qaeda leaders, what impact is that having, A, on the organization, and B, on the radicalization of the organization?
Well, that's a very, very difficult question to answer, at least completely, partly because it's difficult to get access to some of that information in the tribal areas. So we know that it has the drone strikes have clearly and negatively impacted al-Qaeda's ability to function. It's had several attacks that have been foiled because leaders have been killed. But I would say at the same time, it's also caused a great amount of concern among Pakistani citizens, the Pakistan government, which continues to argue very publicly that the drone strikes, it does not support the drone strikes, even though in many cases it actually is supporting the strikes behind the scenes. But then the question is, and it's not entirely clear, how much this is radicalizing some individuals. The drones appear to kill very few civilians, but I suspect there are some number of individuals that have radicalized because of them.
Talk a little bit about the movement, what seems to be the movement of Al-Qaeda into various places in Asia.
Well, when you look across several continents, I would say the Arab Spring in particular has weakened multiple regimes. When you look further east in Asia, there have been efforts for Al-Qaeda to get more of a footprint into Indonesia and the Philippines. Those governments, both the Indonesian and the Filipino governments, have largely pushed back Al-Qaeda. They have a foothold in some areas, including Mindanao, but Al-Qaeda's ability to gain sanctuary have tended to be more recently in places like Mali, Nigeria, Syria, where Al-Qaeda in Iraq has pushed some fighters into, and then in a few countries that look like it's becoming a cause of concern in Egypt. So the Arab world and Africa appear to be areas where Al-Qaeda appears to have gotten a foothold more than in, say, Indonesia and the Philippines.
As we see more turmoil as a result of the Arab Spring, how is Al-Qaeda responding to that?
Well, the Arab Spring has had both positive impacts in the sense of encouraging individuals to rise up and support democratization. I mean, I think that's an inherently good aspect. The downside in some countries is that it has also contributed to a weakening of regimes. So governments have had to face a loss of political support. They've dealt with rising insurgencies. And Al-Qaeda has tried to gain a foothold. Now, whether it can continue to do so over the foreseeable future is obviously an open question. But the issue is, I think, where we see regimes weakening in Syria, in Egypt, in Libya, in Mali, and it looks like in Nigeria as well, it will push fighters in, and it has, and it try to establish a foothold and reach out to groups already operating in those countries. And that is a source of extraordinary danger and concern. And again, whether it will succeed is a slightly separate issue. It's desperately trying.
But it does seem like that there's an interim step, too, in that they're also engaged in maximum efforts to destabilize the regimes in these countries where we've seen the Arab Spring, not necessarily knowing what the outcome will be, but arguing that destabilization at least keeps them in play.
Well, that's right, because it actually forces the government and security forces to deal with a number of different groups, allowing it to a little bit more freedom of action in some cases. So if you look at Syria, for example, and this is where the West, including the United States, have to be very careful. The Syrian government is now facing a range of heterogeneous militant groups, some which you might consider very legitimate. They're an individual seeking democratic process in Syria. But you also have some terrorist groups, including Al-Qaeda in Iraq cells, that have pushed in. So in this vacuum, because the government now has to deal with a range of groups, Al-Qaeda has established a foothold and has perpetrated several attacks.
What is your sense of what the future, what the ongoing state of Al-Qaeda looks like?
I would say, based on recent trends, even over the past year, Al-Qaeda will likely become a more decentralized organization. It will continue to have some core command element in Pakistan. Its influence may be increasingly less important, and we'll see a rise in the importance of its affiliates in Yemen, in Somalia, in North Africa, in Iraq. And so the question for the United States and other Western governments will be, how successful will they be in ensuring democratization processes that don't also so weaken governments that they allow groups like Al-Qaeda, its affiliates, or its allies like Boko Haram in Nigeria to increasingly gain a foothold. Because I think that's in nobody's interest.
Seth Jones, the book is Hunting in the Shadows, The Pursuit of Al-Qaeda Since 9/11. Seth, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks, Jeff.